Agutavach, Shavua Tov. Today's shiur is sponsored by Dr. Zucker, Le'ili Nishmas, his father, Yitzhak Chaim ben Yosef Olav HaSholem. Tonight is the Yortzeit. I also want to make mention of the Kedoshim Etoirim of Mumbai, which we tragically experienced. Hashem Yikom Dumom, V'tayish Nishmusam Tzruru V'tzror HaChaim. Today's topic is a continuation of the previous shiurim, and tonight we will discuss the brain death controversy in Jewish law. But first I want to make a clarification. I had an impression in the previous shiur that some listeners were expecting to go away from here with clear instructions how to deal with an end-of-life situation. This was not my intention at all. As I explained already, I strongly believe that these issues should be addressed by teamwork, combining both the medical and halachic experts to find acceptable solutions in each specific case. The variables to consider when deciding a proper course of action are very complex, so that each individual case can be profoundly different than the previous one. Ultimately, most cases are to be cited by a judgment call, which necessitates both medical and halachic expertise. Our shiurim are intended to explore from an academic point of view the issues which will inevitably be factors which this team will examine. Therefore, I feel that no definitive halachic conclusions should be reached on the basis of this shiurim. Having said that, let's start looking at the issue which we're addressing now. Every morning we say the brucha, Elokai neshumu shenusatu bi tohiruhi, atu verusa, atu yitzarta, atu nefachta bi, v'atu usad litla mimeni ila achziro bil usid. And I'll translate, Hashem, the soul you gave me is pure, you created it, and you breathed it into me, and you will take it from me and return it in the future. Life is when God plants a soul in our bodies, and death is when He takes it back. Only Hashem, who is the source of all life, can grant life and ultimately take life away. Since no one has ever seen a neshama leave a body, it is therefore virtually impossible to use scientific tools, which were designed for our physical three-dimensional world, to define the exact moment of death. The clinical signs we will be discussing are only indications that death has already occurred, but cannot pinpoint the precise moment it happened. Therefore, whatever halachic definition for death we will come up with must be based on clear and unequivocal passages found in the Torah, which is the source of whatever we know about our spirituality. The issue of end of life has been known from the dawn of time. Mankind has had to cope with these life end of life issues since man was around. Defining death traditionally was quite straightforward. Everyone could determine that a lifeless body was dead. And society in general didn't have a real need for a more exact definition. In halacha, we did have many issues which necessitated a more precise definition. For instance, Hilchos Shabbos, knowing if pikuach nefesh is allowed or not, we have to know if this person we're working on is alive or dead. Tumas Kohanim, a Kohen can only enter a room where a patient is alive. Marital relationships, a woman is allowed to remarry only when her husband is dead. So we have to know, is he alive or dead? This is only an example where halacha did have, through the ages, an issue with the exact definition of death. With the advent of transplant surgery, this issue came to the forefront of the medical community as well. It's interesting to note that in 1968, when the Harvard criteria for brain death was announced, this coincided with the development of cyclosporin and other anti-rejection agents that are needed in transplant surgery. So when we started dealing with transplant surgery, it became vital to define more precisely what is the moment of death, because organs can only be transplanted when they're harvested while they were viable, while there's still circulation going on. Another pressing concern was the need to resolve the problem of scarcity of medical resources. The medical establishment field has a problem with allocating precious resources for seemingly, so to speak, futile patients when they can be used for more productive uses. And a third factor which we can identify is there's an increasing sensitivity to the apparent suffering of a terminal patient. Healthcare providers are feeling more and more uncomfortable prolonging a life of pain when there's no chance of survival or at least an improvement of the patient's condition. These are valid concerns, and this generated a lot of discussion and research into finding a more precise definition of the moment of death. As I mentioned before, halacha has its sources, and since this is essentially a spiritual event when the soul leaves the body, we have to turn to our eternal sources to find what the halachic stand is in this cardinal question, the definition of death. In halacha, the issues involved are very major. If a person is alive, anything we do to shorten his life is homicide, is murder, is retzach. And this is one of the three cardinal sins in the Torah. Yeherek val yaver. And when a person is alive, the biggest mitzvah in the Torah is saving a life, maintaining a life, preserving a life. Pikuach nefesh is doich lekol mitzvah shev Torah. On the other hand, the moment the person is not alive anymore, we have to be careful about nivul ames. There's kavod ames. We have to do everything to maintain the dignity of the human body. So we have a terrible dilemma. We have to know when do we do this and when do we do that. So let's take a look at one of the sources quoted as a possible source to solve this problem. The Gemara says in Masechtas Yuma, Daf Paichai Umed Aleph, Tun Rabunan, Misha Nufel Ulav Hagal, a person who is buried under rubble, a collapsed building or whatever, and we're trying to take him out of there. And we're talking about something that happened Shabbos. It involves Chilul Shabbos. Ad Haichen Hu Boidik, when we start uncovering the body, and we want to check if he's alive or not, because if he's not alive anymore, we have to stop whatever we're doing, because it's Chilul Shabbos. How do we know if he's alive or not? One mandormer says, Ad Choytmoy, we have to check his nostrils, if we can discern any breathing. But yes, omrim ad liboy. We have to continue removing the rubble until we reach his heart and to see if there's cardiac activity. And the one says, a source for that shita that says, ad choytmoy, why breathing is so important, because the pasuk says, kol asher nishmas ruach chayim be'apov. The life of a person is seen be'apov, in his breathing. Omer Rav Pupa explains, Machloikes mematu lemalu. When we're uncovering this person from the bottom up, first we reach his feet, then we go move up, uncovering the body, and we reach his heart, his chest. We don't see his head or face yet. And one mandomer says, check his heartbeat. If you don't see any heartbeat, he's dead. And the other one says, no, you can't rely on heartbeat, you have to continue until you reach his face and to see if he's breathing or not. Avul mimalu lematu, if we start uncovering him from the top down, kivin the budikla at choitmoy, the minute you see his nose and he's breathing, he's not breathing, shiv ainit surah. More, you don't have to check anymore. So we see from here as a machlokes. Can we rely on cardiac activity? One man domer. The other one says no. Cardiac activity is not enough. You have to check if he's breathing or not. But it seems from this gemara. But if you check his breathing and you see he's not breathing, the cardiac activity, if it's there or not, is irrelevant. But Rashi adds a very important note here. Rashi says, what are we talking about? What type of situation? Rashi explains. Im doimel emes, if this person resembles a mess, a dead body. Sha'ino maizes ivorov, he's not moving, he's unresponsive. Ad haichen hu mefakeach lada'as hu emes, how far do we have to continue to know the truth, if he's alive or not? Ad choitmoy, you have to continue until his nose. If we don't see signs of life in his nose, for instance, Rashi says, "Sha'ino moitzi ruach." There's no air coming out. Vada imes, and you can leave him there. So Rashi adds a very important point here. Rashi says, this whole machloikas, this whole argument, if we look at his nose or look at his heart, it's only when we have a person who resembles a dead body. There's no movement at all. So we want to know, are we sure that he's not alive or not? So we have to check if there's breathing. Another one says, it's enough when you check his heart. L'choira, at first glance, it looks like we have a machloikas here, if respiratory arrest is enough, or we need cardiac arrest, or both, or any one of the two is a machloikas. And since the halacha is that respiratory arrest is what matters, we have to continue. We can't rely on cardiac activity, because sometimes cardiac activity, since it's covered, it's hidden within the chest, and when a person doesn't have any medical instruments, he can't really know if there's cardiac activity or not. He can feel for the pulse, but otherwise, sometimes you don't feel a pulse, but still there's some activity, some life in this body. You have to continue digging until you see if he's breathing or not. As I said, some poskim wanted to understand this gemara as saying that breathing or cessation of respiratory activity is enough to declare a person dead. And you don't have to check his heart. Or in the classical question we have, what happens when the heart continues beating because it's mechanically maintained, but there's no spontaneous breathing, if this is considered life or not. So some would learn from this Gemara that the main thing is respiratory arrest. Number one, as I mentioned, from Rashi we see that it's not the case. Because Rashi says when the respiratory arrest is not a definition of death. It's a clinical sign to know that whatever we see and it resembles death is really dead, because there's no breathing going on. But to say that when the body is functioning and there's just a respiratory arrest, that this is also considered death, this is arguable. It's not that clear from here. And also we have to add that respiratory arrest needs a very, very clear condition that has to be irreversible. There's no question in anyone's mind that respiratory arrest, which might be reversible, not only this person is very much can be very much alive, there's every mitzvah to do anything in our power to resuscitate him. We have to bring him back. A person can develop respiratory arrest for a whole range of reasons, and if this condition is reversible, there's no question about it. There's a mitzvah of pikuach nefesh. Everything has to be done to bring him back. And if he is if the team is successful in bringing him back, this is not a matter of Tchiyas HaMaisim. There's no question about it. He wasn't dead and he was resurrected. He was never dead. He was alive all the time. Why isn't this condition mentioned in this sugya and this Gemara? Number one, it's possible that artificial respiration wasn't known back then. So when a person stopped breathing, you just gave up and you considered him dead. But now, since artificial respiration in more sophisticated manners of resuscitating have been developed, there's no question in anyone's mind that this person is very much alive and everything has to be done to bring him back. Irreversibility in respiratory arrest is also not enough to designate the person as being dead. We all know that there's a variety of diseases or conditions which can cause irreversible respiratory arrest. That means there's no spontaneous breathing. The person can never breathe on his own. Nevertheless, everyone would agree that such a person can be very much alive if he can be kept alive by artificial means. For instance, just to mention a few, a polio patient, a quadriplegic, which has injury in the cervical spine. He can't breathe on his own, but he's very much alive. Degenerative diseases such as ALS is also, they can't breathe on their own, and there's irreversible respiratory arrest, but he can be kept alive. There's a very famous scientist called Stephen Hawking. He can't breathe on his own, but he's very much alive. And these people can be very productive and lead productive lives, but they can't breathe on their own. So irreversible respiratory arrest is also not enough. We have to say, therefore, that what the Gemara mentions about respiratory arrest is only in the context of a person losing other abilities. The body can't function. We'll try to look at how to enhance these conditions, but I just want to make sure that we all agree that respiratory arrest, even if it's irreversible, is also not enough to be a clinical symptom of death. Now let's take a look at one of the shittas that hold that brain death is enough. One of the shittas is the Rabbanut HaRashit in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, which in 1990 made that famous decision that brain death is considered death, and they allowed the Hadassah Hospital to go ahead and start doing transplants. They based their decision on this Gemara. Since in the Gemara we see, in the Talmud we see, that respiratory arrest is the only sign which should be looked at when we have to decide if a person is alive or not. And they added, it has to be irreversible respiratory arrest. So they decided that mot geza hamoach, brain death, is the definition of irreversible respiratory arrest, which is considered death. Many poskim, if not the vast majority of the poskim in our generation, disagree with that decision. For the very simple fact, I just explained that irreversible respiratory arrest is also not enough, because there are conditions that people have this type of definition and they're very much alive. So just basing it on this passage in the Gemara is lacking. And this was brought to the attention of the Rabbanut HaRashit, and they realized that this is not enough. You can't just take a look at the Gemara and say irreversible respiratory arrest is death, and decide on your own this means brain death or brainstem death, and then we realize that's not enough. We need more correlating evidence that this person is not alive. And of course, when you take a look at Rashi, what Rashi says that hafsakat haneshima, breathing the rest, is not enough. The person has to look dead. That means that the Chasam Sofer defines a person as being dead when he lies still as a stone. There's no movement at all. Only then is a person considered dead when he doesn't breathe. So to take this one point out of context and saying this is what it depends, life and death depends on irreversible respiratory arrest, they realized it's not enough. So later on, one of the Rabbonim added another condition to the definition of the Rabbanut Rashid, which is in addition to irreversible respiratory arrest, has to be brain death, which is defined or diagnosed with all the relevant tests. There has to be profound unresponsiveness. So that's the way they explain what the Chasam Sofer is saying. Profound unresponsiveness, that means he's mutal ke'even, he's lying still as a stone. But the problem with that is that when a person's heart is beating and there is circulation going on, it's very difficult to say that this person looks like a stone. And an important part of his body, which in his life was functioning, is continued to function. So how do you take that and say that this is like a stone? Yes?
How come when you're uncovering the person under rubble and you're going from the top down, mm-hmm. stop at the nose? Don't you need to go down to the heart? You're suggesting that it's not just respiratory. It is movement, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So how could you stop uncovering him only at the nose and declare him dead? Why don't you have to uncover him?
Because as I mentioned before, Rashi says that the Gemara is talking about a person who looks dead. That's the lesson of Rashi. Doim elemesha ayinu maizes ayverov. And he looks dead. For all, in all through the ages, this person would have been declared dead. But we want to make sure that he's not breathing.
But he's under rubble. How do you know?
I don't know.
So what's the problem with Rashi? I mean, if you're saying Batima, that's what you're saying. Now, you're saying Batima Chosmo. At this point, I would not know if he's mutal ke'even lo mizizir at all.
But you know, what you're hinting at is also not an explanation for Rashi, because if there's spontaneous cardiac activity, then he's alive. Everyone agrees to that. Only when the cardiac activity is mechanically maintained, they're arguing.
I'm sorry, that's not true. I don't think it's true, because cardiac activity is not mechanically maintained in any of these cases.
How is it maintained?
The heart keeps beating. The brain can be dead. You could be on a respirator. The heart keeps beating.
Not always.
There may or may not be. That's not really relevant. I mean, you could. There could be cases where you don't need drugs to maintain the blood pressure,
but it's dependent on respiration.
Well, if the person is not able to breathe and he's not put on a ventilator, he will eventually die. We know that, but that's not what we're talking about. But if the person...
So maybe this is the answer, but we kept asking here, because if a person is not breathing, then it's inevitable that his heart will stop.
Yes.
His heart can't continue beating without any respiration. The heart needs oxygen.
Yes, but I think the issue that is debated right now is whether you can rely on the fact that he's already dead by virtue of the fact that he stopped breathing. Someone could have stopped breathing and their heart could continue for several minutes.
Okay, well...
So then the issue is germane.
And which is the moment of death in that case?
So the Gemara is not really discussing the moment of death, because the Gemara is taking a look if this person is alive or not. When he died or when...
But he might still
Absolutely.
Be, the point is, he might still be alive. I think the whole issue, the key issue here, what you're suggesting is that since his heart is beating, the fact that he's lying there inanimate and his brain is completely gone, he cannot be considered like dead. Right? I think mm-hmm. that's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of the Gemara, that could be exactly what's going on.
We can understand what the Gemara is saying, that since he's crushed in such a manner, if there's no breath going on, then he didn't stop breathing now. He stopped breathing when he was buried. So if he's not breathing now, if he's breathing now, it's possible that he was breathing all along and he's alive. But if he's not breathing now, he didn't stop breathing at this moment. He was covered.
I'm not trying to harp on a minor point because this whole issue if you say if the heart is beating, the person cannot be dead, then transplants are completely out of the question.
I'm not here to.
No, but I'm just.
I'm here to let's explore together and take a look at the various sitters. Okay, if transplants can go ahead or not, this is not for us to decide.
I understand that, but the implications of this fine differentiation are very important.
Absolutely.
So if.
What I'm saying is an opinion of a very vast majority of Rabbonim, of Poskim. So I'm not deciding here if you can do transplants or not. But so let's take a look at the various shittas. So this is one shitta, and I just mentioned the problematics of this shitta. There's another passage in the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Maseches Aholos Perek Aleph. The Mishnah says, Udam Aine Metame. A person is not metame, timus mes, he's not dead. Acha taitzei nafshoi. Afilu meguyed, afilu he was sliced apart. Afilu goises. He's still zoikik liyibum, poitim en ayibum. He's alive for all dinai Torah. And the same applies to a baim mevachaya, an animal. Ein metame, this animal is not metame, timus neveile. Acha taitzei nafshom. Until the animal is dead. Hutsu Roshayim, if they were decapitated, the heads were removed, Afopishim Afarchasin, although there's still movement, spastic movement, Tumayin, Kegoin Zanav Halatu'u, like the tail of a lizard, Shim Afarchasis, a lizard can throw away its tail.
Sikresha.
So here an interesting definition. Although there is movement, there's pirchus. It's not movement which is signals life. This is spastic movement, reflexes.
And the heart still beats.
The heart can still beat, but this person is dead. So we see that decapitation is not only a harbinger of death, it will bring death. No, that moment. A person cannot live without a head. And if there's no head, the person is not alive. And we also see from here that although there is movement in the body, parts of his body are still look like they're alive, but since there's no head, this is not considered any signs of life. So, theoretically, if a person is without a head, his brain is destroyed, we can argue that although his heart is still beating, or he has other types of reflexes going on, this should not be seen as a person who is alive. Hagaon Reb Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livrucha, had three tshuvas on this issue of brain death. The problem is that these three tshuvas, these three responses are not consistent. It looks like there's a contradiction between the three tshuvas. In one tshuva, he bases his opinion that you can rely on brain death on this Mishnah. And he says that physiological decapitation is similar to actual decapitation. And there are many, many discussions. What is the real shitta of Reb Moshe? Because when you take a close look at these three tshuvas, you can't come up with a clear picture. For instance, when Reb Moshe mentions physiological decapitation, he explains that since he was told, when you do this angiogram and you see there's no blood flow to the brain, the whole brain is rotted. The brain is rotten. That's the translation from Hebrew. Kol ha-moach nirkav. Nirkavon means rotted away. That means there's no brain tissue left anymore. It's decomposed. So therefore, what's the difference between that, says Reb Moshe, and decapitation? So if decapitation is considered death, this should also be considered death. Number one, it might be possible that Reb Moshe based this psak on inaccurate medical advice he was given. I read some interesting articles. Dr. Sander provided us with very enlightening articles, and over there they bring down that on post-mortems that were performed on brain death patients, most of the brains were intact.
The problem is that
No.
The pathology that used to be done and these sorts of brains were in fact liquefied and necrotic at the time when Rav Moshe wrote that tshuva. And the reason for that was because people spent several days where they really just had a heartbeat and brainstem death, at which point that's what the pathology looks like. If you make the declaration earlier, then you do not see those abnormalities. So what he said was true. The question is just simply inevitability.
Okay.
The brain was as rotten.
Yes, but the moment that death was declared, was the brain already rotten?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Yes, you're saying now it wasn't.
No, well, I mean, neither is the brain rotten with hutaz rosho. Because at the very moment...
No, different. Hutaz rosho means that there's no connection between the brain and the body. But when it's not hutaz rosho, you have to come up with a definition or invent it yourself, saying that when the brain is not functioning, it's similar to hutaz rosho.
If I would be able to put the person's head on a perfusion bypass machine at the moment of hutaz rosho, his brain would continue to function.
Okay. So.
Right, and so when you're going to, you can't mix the arguments. In other words, either they're going to be disconnected, and the disconnection can be one way or the other, or you're going to argue pathology. And if you're going to argue pathology, then I'm saying to you that the brain tissue is more viable at the moment of hutaz rosho than it is at the declaration of brain.
But that's not relevant to our discussion, because hutaz rosho means that any function the brain still has, any function,
right,
does not have any effect on the body, because it's removed from the body.
Right.
But if the brain was not removed from the body, it's just declared as brain dead, there might be some function still going on. And this paper you provided us states that very clearly. There's still homeostasis, there's hormone regulation. There are a few functions which continue to go on. And since these functions are going on, there's no one who can say that this is just like decapitation.
But you know what? But if you would ask Dr. Natel, I'm sure he would tell you that at the moment of cardiac arrest, there's plenty of viable cardiac tissue.
I heard that argument too, but that's not the same issue.
It's a question of the time course, because let's say you were able to cut off the circulation to the brain. So you clamp both vertebral arteries, both carotid arteries, and there's no circulation. It's just like if you cut off the circulation to your leg, you'll eventually get gangrene, but not on day one. So the description of the liquefied brain is after
that's
a number of days of no circulation, but at the moment that the event occurs, which makes that inevitable, the brain is not liquefied, nor is your leg gangrene.
So the Poiskim argue that only total liquefaction of the brain is decapitation. But if you just disconnect the blood flow to the brain is still alive. Although it's starting to die, maybe down the road it's going to be dead, but at this moment...
I don't know on what basis one would ever make such a distinction. I mean, there's quite clear that pathology lags many, many days behind.
Listen, as I said in my introduction, death is something which we don't understand. It's spiritual. You're taking a look at a physical body and trying to define what in your eyes is life or death. We can only look at these cases through the eyes of Chazal in the Gemara. And the Gemara says death is when there's decapitation. If you can suction out the whole brain tissue or remove the head, that I would agree is decapitation. But if since there's brain tissue there and there is some function of the brain still going on, although brain stem death was declared, some function is still going on. And no one knows what type of function of the brain is still considered life. We don't know that. I'm sorry. We can always continue arguing through the night, but that's not the issue here. The issue is we don't know what is death unless it completely resembles what the Mishnah says. And there's a difference. Yes?
Well, that Mishnah, I think, gave three examples. It said when the spirit goes out, does it go to any more depth as what that means when the spirit goes out?
The Mishnah didn't mention that. The Mishnah meant what? The Mishnah, you're talking about?
When it's called a tall
grain, when it's called a tall grain.
The Mishnah says, Chutas Roishai.
But there was an example. You see, each one stated, this doesn't occur until the spirit goes out. Does it go into any more depth of what that means?
No, actually, it's an option. Actually, it's an option. Means that it's death. What is death? Death was what was known and understood all through the ages. A lifeless body is dead.
In Rav Moshe's tshuva,
yes,
you would have done the angiogram very early. You would have also have seen the same absence of circulation well before liquefaction.
Why? No, what I'm saying is, Rav Moshe was told that when you do the angiogram, that means the brain is rotted. And that's not the case. As you said before, it takes some time for the brain to decompose. So,
but why, one second, but the argument is the other way around. Why does he rely on the brain being rotten? Because at that point, there's no possibility of function.
Okay, this is already lambdas. We can't go with lambdas here. We have a Mishnah. The Mishnah says decapitation. Decapitation means there's no head anymore. This body doesn't have a head anymore. Mm-hmm. As long as there's brain tissue, even though you decide that this brain tissue is not functioning, and this brain tissue is dead, but something is going on in that brain. You see that?
If you decapitated somebody, a whole human being, and you connected artificially blood going to their head, you could keep that brain alive.
Mm-hmm.
I think these are specific instances. So the definition of death, there may be many definitions of death. So one would be decapitation.
Mm-hmm.
So even though if you would do a biopsy of the brain a second after decapitation, it would be normal brain.
That's right.
Okay.
So that's our problem. That's our problem. Decapitation is death because the brain has no connection with the body. But a brain that stays in the body, it's just declared as brain dead, is not similar to decapitation because some part of this brain is still intact.
If you would deconverse and you would now remove the person's heart, now the heart is not functioning, it has to be taken out of the body. And the person is now on bypass.
Mm-hmm.
And also stay on bypass, would he be dead?
No. So this happens every day. When you don't.
So then what is the difference? You know, in other words, when we come to the heart, we're willing to accept viability, non-viability, partial viability. But when it comes to the brain, and Hutaz Rosho, suddenly we start saying there may be four cells in the hypothalamus that are still functioning, and so that is useful. I think that's not the issue. I mean,
that you
either have to be.
You're an expert in medicine. I'm not that much of an expert in halacha to refute what the Gedolei Yisrael say. The Gedolei Yisrael decided that decapitation means total removal of the brain, and if there's some function in the brain, we can't declare this person as dead yet.
But see, it doesn't matter what the state of the brain is in decapitation. Whether it's functioning, not functioning. I mean, the act of decapitation,
mm-hmm,
in and of itself is a definition of death.
Correct.
You don't have to worry about it. So that's one definition. And then another definition is irreversible breathing with the person having no movement.
So you're going to find decapitation. Because the logic for grace and death is that that's an index of decapitation. If you don't have that as a premise, that decapitation of death, and that it follows that brain and death is an index of decapitation, you can't make the argument for brain death.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
You're predicating your rejection of Rav Moshe's thought on your interpretation of something that you may have misunderstood. That seems to me to be not such a strong refutation. Maybe he did understand it. And if he did understand it, would you then be uncomfortable rejecting his
son? Well, this is not my words, but I'm just saying. This is a big controversy about Rav Moshe's opinion. Rav Moshe's opinion from the Tshuvas is unclear. What is clear is that his son-in-law, Rabbi Tandler, and his son, Rav David, verbally said Rav Moshe held that way. But when you take a close look at the Tshuvas, that's not the impression that's coming out of the Tshuvas. Many Gedolei Yisrael learned the Tshuvas and they said Rav Moshe's opinion was different. For instance, Rav Moshe says when you check the brainstem with the angiogram and you see there's no circulation, the life support might be removed. He didn't say you can harvest organs. So they say, we see from here that Rav Moshe didn't say you can just remove organs and kill the person.
I understand you correctly. You said it's very controversial. It must mean there are others who do agree with Rav Moshe. You agree with this interpretation of Rav Moshe.
Again, yes, yes. Rav Moshe's son-in-law and Rav Moshe's son, although Rav Moshe's son, Rav David Zalzangerson, said he didn't have a close discussion with his father on this, but the only one really who strongly supports this interpretation is Rav Tendler. And many Gedolei Yisrael, let's say most Gedolei Yisrael, and it's interesting to point out that, you know, we take a look at the spectrum of rabbinic opinions, we have the more extreme, the less extreme, to the left, to the right, if you can use those expressions. One of the strongest opponents to this approach is the Rabbonim from the RCA, the Rabbonim from the YU, Rabbi David Bleich, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, Rabbi Soloveitchik Olav Shalom, they were very strongly against this approach. And they felt only total liquefaction of the brain is considered brain death. So they totally disagreed. And the same we hear from the other part of the spectrum, the Gedolei Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. I can mention any names, the Tzitzi Eliezer, the Rav Wozner Shlita, Rav Ovadia, Rav Eliashev, Shlomo Zalman, all were very much against this approach. So this is a controversy where we're not going to resolve it. It's only the Beit Nagudel Shebe Yerushalayim, when Mashiach will come, we'll be able to say what is right. Yes?
So, I'm sorry to hold this point, not just a physical issue, then can we glibly say that at the moment of physical death, that's when the neshama leaves the body? Or you mentioned that a goy says, although it's inevitable he's going to die, it's inevitable this death is going to happen, at what stage do we know that the neshama actually depart from the body?
That's what I mentioned in my opening remarks. We can only know when a person is dead. We don't know when he died. Because the exact moment when the neshama departs, we don't know. There are many things that happen in medicine which you can't put a finger and say, now, it happened now. Conception. Who knows when the moment of conception? We don't know that. You know, conception takes time. There's a span of 72 hours or even more that when conception can happen. So we don't know the exact moment of the beginning of life. So it's quite possible that we can't pinpoint the moment of death. But we know when we see it that a person is lifeless. We're trying to narrow that down this period of Sufik, because we need it for transplant. Now I would like to go into depth the issue of the shita of Reb Shlomo Zalman. But before that, I want to make a remark. Maybe you will agree to me or not. We see in all areas of life that when there is a need for something or a demand for something, it generates innovation and invention. Of course, everyone agrees that there's a need for organ transplants. The easy way to solve this problem is to play around with the definition of death. Move it up a bit so we can have more organs. There are other ways which are more difficult and maybe farther down the line, which is stem cell research, and that can also provide organs for transplant. But the easier way to do it is to have it or harvest it. But if the approach would be that this is a problem with a moral problem, a halachic problem, maybe more resources would be invested in stem cell research and found, and other options to be developed. So this is the feeling I have, and I think I want to share it.
One of the problems with the stem cell research is that there are many Christians and other fundamentalist groups who feel as strongly about stem cells.
Okay, so I'm not entitled to that. The same. I also have a moral problem with this approach. Yeah, and it was now publicized. The Catholic Church just again disagreed with stem cell research, only embryonic stem cell research. But the halacha doesn't have a problem with that. So we have a valid argument here.
There is another issue. There is the issue of transplantation, which is perhaps more impelling because it could take a life. There's also the issue of people who are have no detectable brain function at all, and they're on life support systems and have grieving relatives who may be...
Yes. I mentioned that in my opening remarks, that this is a valid concern. Allocation of scarce medical resources and also suffering for the family. Yes, this is a valid concern, but I think by invoking the halachas of goyses, we can solve those problems. People aren't aware. Goyses, this is a whole, I think the coming year will be on that issue. Goyses are many treatments which can be withheld. And if people would be aware of that, if they would consult with competent halachic experts, they would find a way to answer those problems. So by redefining death, not that is the approach to do. We have to redefine our approach to goyses. And if we do that, I think we can solve most of these problems. Goyses is the phase between life and death, the last stage of life.
But wasn't it clear from last time, Shir, when we were here, that the problem isn't once you've established goyses, then you know more or less how to act. But the problem is with all the technology, the differentiation between goyses and Chai Yeshua became nightmarish. And that
correct. But so let's look into it more in detail. So maybe we'll find a way which you can have some sure footing and to know what to do when the time arises. There was an interesting development with Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Shita Olav Sholem, and there's some interesting research that the doctors did, and I want to share it with you. In 1990, the RCA came out with their living will, and this stirred up a lot of controversy, because in that living will, a person can decide that he wants to accept the brain death definition. Agav, I want to mention that the new law in Eretz Yisrael, which allows for brain death definition, also has a clause that a person can accept any shit that he wants when it comes to brain death. If he wants to go according to the Rabbanut or according to the other approaches. So it's the person has an autonomy to decide if he wants his family to adhere to this shitta or that shitta. So that's an important clause which should be in any law to respect the religious freedom of the patient. When this controversy came to the table of Reb Shlomo Zalman in 1991, He said then he has a problem with the definition of brain death because of a Gemara in Maseches Arichin. The Gemara in Maseches Arichin talks about a pregnant woman which has died, and the question is if Daf Zayin Umud Aleph, Arichin Daf Zayin Umud Aleph. The Gemara states there very unequivocally that a pregnant woman that has died a natural death, her fetus cannot survive a moment after her. The fetus cannot live a moment after the mother. So, in all probability, the fetus was dead before the mother died. And the Gemara says there, over there, differentiates between if it happened during childbirth, because then it's possible that the fetus has already his own life. But if it happened during the pregnancy, it's not possible for a fetus to survive after his mother is not alive anymore. So Shlomo Zalman asked, since it's medical knowledge that a woman that's brain dead can be sustained on life support for weeks and then deliver a live baby, so that means that that brain death cannot be considered death, because it's against the Gemara. The Gemara says a woman who's dead cannot have a live baby. And here we see that a woman that's brain dead can have a live baby.
What if I'm Mati Zorosha, I could still deliver a live baby? That's a fact.
What did you say?
If I would decapitate the woman...
Okay, so the doctors sitting with Reb Shlomo Zalman argued that the Gemara said that fact when there was no life support systems. But now we have life support systems, maybe we can maintain the life of the mother until she gives the life birth. Is it possible or not? So Reb Shlomo Zalman said, let's see if it's possible. So there were a few doctors that arranged such a research, such a test, and they set out, they brought a pregnant sheep, and the doctors there were Rav Yigal Safran and Dr. Avram Steinberg, famous names, and they set up in one of the universities, university hospitals, such a test. Let's try it out. They brought a pregnant sheep, and they connected her to life support, and they anesthetized the sheep that shouldn't be a child of Tzar Balachayim. And then they suctioned out the brain, and they were checking, monitoring the fetus, and it was still alive for half an hour. I think for half an hour. Exactly. Yeah, they said they did intubation, they were monitoring the blood pressure and the pulse. And they were checking the astrop, and they were checking the electrolytes, whatever. And the brain was suctioned out, and the mother was without a brain for 3 hours. And then the fetus died. So they were arguing. So from here we see that when there's life support, the klal of the Gemara wasn't said, because the Gemara only was talking about a situation where there's no natural life and death. So the doctors were arguing, we can't bring a raya from this, because here, how did you know that the fetus was alive? By checking the pulse and so it's a cardiac activity. So the same was with the mother. The mother was hutas roisha. The mother was without her brain, and there was also pulse. So how do you know that the fetus was alive? So they tried again, and this time, number one, they removed the whole skull. It was decapitated, and they waited a half an hour, and then they took out the fetus, the lamb, and it was alive, very much alive. So that was a very definitive conclusion that the Gemara can't be used as a raya lekan lekan, because the Gemara was stating this fact only as long as there was no life support. But with the advent of life support, it's possible that after the mother is really dead by decapitation by hutas roshay, so there's no question about it that even if brain death is considered death, a live child can be born.
Right.
So after, yes?
You're using animals, I mean, I'm not sure it's a reputation, but there's laws in Shechita, you know, that if you find the blood alive, mm-hmm. you don't have to shecht it.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't that go against that? They're saying that the child can survive after the mother's death.
That's a good question, but Shechita in and of itself is not death yet. It's only halachically considered dead. A person is not metame, even though he was nishchat shnei simonim, chas v'shulam, a human being that was his throat was slashed. He's not metame yet. He's not considered dead. Decapitation is death. So they had to try this test by decapitation. Only then there would be a definitive raya lekan or lekan if it's possible to give life a life birth after the mother is dead.
Lamb lived for a half hour after the decapitation.
The lamb was born and lived and grew up.
Even though it was incapacitated, the lamb still was alive.
Yes.
The mother was decapitated.
The mother was decapitated. The mother was decapitated, and the mother was kept on life support. The mother was kept on life support until the child was born. After this test was done, there were a lot of rumors that Reb Shlomo Zalman changed his mind. And from that moment on, they were saying that he changed his opinion and he felt that brain death is sufficient. He had a lot of aggravation from that, and he publicized a very clear his opinion very clearly. Shlomo Zalman's opinion is that a person who is declared as brain dead, brain stem dead, is sufik geisus, sufik mes. It's possible that he's dead, but it's possible that he's not dead, because part of his brain is still functioning. The hypothalamus, the pituitary, it might be functioning. Maybe other parts of his brain might be still functioning. And this was, yes?
But is that only a basis in this situation?
This is let me explain. The Shlomo Zalman felt that the diagnosis of brain death is enough to classify a person as goyses. Although we don't have the classic signs of goyses, but if he's brain dead, he's definitely goyses. He can also be dead. So it's a sufik goyses, sufik death. And the nafka min al halacha is that since there's a sufik goyses, it's possible that he's alive.
Yeah.
You can't harvest any organs. But he did hold that since he's not more than a goyses, the respiration can be discontinued because that's only like an external impediment to death. That's an important note what he says here, that and this is the only instance where we find that he said it very clearly. Hasarat moneah, exactly. He felt that this is hasarat moneah, and it's logical too because if it's only mechanical, we have to supply nutrition, we have to supply oxygen, but it doesn't mean we have to supply it forcefully with the respiration. So Shlomo Zalman felt that since it's not more than a goysis, he's definitely not a terminal patient which should be kept alive. Therefore, he felt that respiration can be discontinued.
So the nafka mina of this would be essentially that you don't necessarily have to ventilate brainstem dead patients, but transplants become still a very big problem.
Exactly.
You can then die, you can't kill it. But if you don't maintain respirations...
Can't transplant?
No. Within 3 minutes, the patient's going to be dead.
Right.
Halakhically.
Right.
So not only 3 minutes, he goes down and he says it's enough for 30 seconds.
He
quotes many doctors saying that after 30 seconds in a brain dead patient, which is ceased to breathe, they would sign a death certificate.
So then because then you have a lack of breathing.
Yes.
Then you have to work.
But then he retracted and said these 30 seconds is only enough maybe to sign a certificate, but he wouldn't allow to harvest organs until another few minutes, until we're sure that all parts of the brain are totally dead. How long that would take, I don't know.
When I actually have a problem with this. When you are doing the brainstem death determination, even when you're actually having the respiration, you do have the patient, first of all, breathing the high oxygen mixture, and then you have them maintained, connected just to a source of oxygen. The oxygen maybe flows back and forth by diffusion, but that's a good 10 minutes where you will really see carbon dioxide going up, the heart beating. For all practical purposes, you will not have any adverse events whatsoever.
Okay, I have an issue with that too, because Shlomo Zalman added that any tests... Since he defined this type of condition as sufik goysis, sufik mess,
right.
In a goysis you're not allowed to move him unless it's for his benefit. Now, to make any test like an angiogram, he felt that it's totally unallowed because you're injecting some sort of maybe it can be considered neutral. It wouldn't damage the patient, but it's definitely more than just moving him. So he felt that these tests are disallowed.
But you don't know he's a goysis until after you do the test.
No, but there are different types of tests. Angiogram is invasive, but maybe there's other types of tests. Now, the apnea test, I have to admit that last week, this year, when you explained the apnea test, I was a bit uneasy, because an apnea test we're doing something very profound to the patient. We're infusing them with a lot of oxygen, and you never know, you mentioned that you have to check his carbon dioxide levels, because otherwise there's no stimulus to breathe. So this is dynamic. This is being defined more and more through the years. 10 years ago, there was no such test.
Oh, yeah.
No, it developed. Oh, 20 years ago, the apnea test was always the same?
Absolutely. Always the same. In other words, what they did with the criteria, from the Harvard criteria, is essentially over the time is that they sharpened the criteria to make sure that you had sufficient stimulus. Because if you, for example, people know very well, if you breathe very quickly, and you can hold your breath for much longer, the reason is because you actually, at some point, need carbon dioxide to breathe. So if you eliminate more of the carbon dioxide, then you don't have such...
Okay, in any case, even though it's very well defined, but we're doing something very major to the body, and it's a goisus, you know. Who knows that by this hyperventilation you're not causing any damage?
Well, this is what I asked you when I sent you the list of questions on the brain. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I asked you is: it ever permitted somebody to do a brain death determination?
Well, according to Shlaim Zalman's understanding, a brain death determination has to be done by not doing something violent or something which might damage, might hasten his death.
I'm moving a limb. I have to move him. I have to touch him. Otherwise, I can't. Even if I, you know, tickle his feet.
So we're back to square one.
So in other words, I would never know. So there really is, a person will come. You won't know what he is. The only way I know what he is by doing it.
Okay, so according to Reb Shlaim Zalman, there's a lechatchil and there's a b'david. If the tests were done and this was diagnosed, then this is the case. But if you ask me if you're allowed to do the tests, it's his opinion would be otherwise.
Shouldn't be allowed to even nurse the patient.
No, that's different. Because if the person, I was just asked if you're allowed to wash a patient who has a goisus. Since this is for his benefit and it makes him feel better, it's something which...
No, the patient's unconscious, doesn't feel it.
Why did they want to wash the person? Because of the people standing there.
Yeah.
I mean, in our eyes.
No, it can develop a pressure sores or other things.
No, but I mean, if he's a goisus, he's not got enough time to develop pressure sores.
Right.
It's a question of dignity, also.
Right. Yes.
You know, Shlomo Zalman explained his reasoning by it. He was given a proof that looks like that you could say apparently he was dead. What was his reasoning by saying it's a goisus?
Because his heart is beating. He doesn't look like that person. The tests show that his brain stem is not functioning, he's dead, but this person looks alive. He's breathing, his chest is moving up and down.
Okay, so in this person, whose heart is functioning, his circulation is being maintained, his breathing is being maintained, once you've declared him goisus, you can not use the machine anymore.
I'll leave that for the specific case we're going to address. I don't want to go... I don't want to give any directives which might be used. We have to take a look at each specific case and see.
Conceptually.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I say once you don't use the machine anymore, that person will be dead within maximum 3 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, I mean, in terms of...
According to the quote I just said from Reb Shlomo Zalman, that's a condition. But you have to be sure that there's brain stem death.
But you've already done that. You've determined the patient that his brain stem dead, and then
they
no longer have the obligation to continue ventilating. Once you've decided not to ventilate him, you know that clinically that and halakhically that patient will be dead within 2 minutes.
Yes. Okay, so what to do in actuality when such a case comes up, we'll discuss in each specific case. Dr. Zucker, you would like to say a Kaddish?
Sure.
Okay, so I'll finish up with a Mishnah. Rabbi Chanan ben Akash, Oyem Meruzza Kaddish Boch, Lezakis Yisrael, Lefich Chir Bolem Toiru V'Mitzvah, Shneimar Adoino Yechuvah Yitzlaman Tzidkoi, Yagdil Toiru V'Yadi.